This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. So, the only thing left to say is, you win? Order now on the McDonald's app, and you can also get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus, rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com. Welcome to a very special edition of the Chelsea Fancast. It's Stamford Chidge here, of course. And occasionally, as you all know, we like to talk to people who have written superb books, usually Chelsea books, usually in cahoots with my great friend, lovely conspirator, Mr. Marco Worrell, who, of course, has published most of them. And they're nearly always about Chelsea. This is not necessarily the case today. But there's a bloody good reason for it. I talked to Marco at the stall about that. About this, it is one of the most incredible books that either of us have come across. So, I mean, it's a complete and utter privilege to do this book today. The book is The Ride to Hell, and it features the amazing Paul Ride, and they're both here today, Marco Worrell and Paul. Marco, good to see you.
And you, mate.
Yeah, it seems kind of like weird seeing you when we're not doing a fan cast, like talking nonsense about Graham Potter or whatever. Graham Potter's Blue and White Army. Today we're going to be more literate and cerebral, aren't we?
Indeed. What else are international breaks for?
Too right, mate. Well, to not talk about football. But hey, I think we will talk a little bit about football today. I have a suspicion that we might. Now, as we all know, you know, you're a lovely, lovely mate and all the rest of it. Chelsea through and through. But of course, You provide an amazing service to the community, the Chelsea community, by both writing and publishing some superb Chelsea books or books on Chelsea that might not otherwise see the light of day. This is a little bit different today. Would you like? I think the honour of introducing our guest really should befall to you. So I'm going to leave that to you. Who have we got on the show today?
So our special guest today is Mr. Paul Ride, Chelsea season ticket holder. Bon viveur, liker of a glass of beer.
Good man.
And a man with a story about his life unlike any other that anybody who knows this story has ever come across, which deserved to be in print. So the backstory is that I think it was probably 6 or 7 years ago now, Paul and I were having a chat at the CFC UK stall, and he told me about a book he'd written, which was kind of a diary come journal that was very, very long. And he sent it to me, and I think it was something like 300,000 words long, which, to put that in Chelsea books context, for those who are familiar with Kelvin Barker's book Celery, representing Chelsea in the 1980s, which was responsible for a lot of forests, deforestation in South America. There's so much paper on it. What Paul sent me would have dwarfed Celery. So I went through it and I thought, we could do something with this, but it would be a major undertaking on the part of both of us. And in the end, it kind of got parked up up until probably this time last year. I think it was around about this time last year. We were in a drinker after the Peter Bonetti memorial service at the bridge. So I had a chat with Paul and I said, look, I'm going to be taking some time out from work this summer to do a couple of book projects. And I've got in my mind to work on your book, but you're going to need to do some work and get it edited down from what it was to something that can be, you know, manageable in terms of a book, which Paul did. And I kind of just spent the summer just editing it, getting to understand it, getting Paul to elaborate on certain areas, so that it kind of had a beginning and a middle and an end, and, you know, did justice to Paul's quite extraordinary story. But also, you know, kind of there's a big mental health angle with the book. There's also a Chelsea angle to the book. So it's kind of like putting all those bits together that would make it, you know, a jolly good read to people who don't, you know, aren't friends of Paul or myself, or who would buy this book. So it's trying to reach out to a wider audience. You know, and I think we got there. So the feedback from people who've read the book has been really positive. And, you know, I think everybody recognises, you know, the ordeal that Paul went through. You know, obviously we can talk about that now. But yeah, that was kind of the backstory to how the book got published. And it's available to buy now. Ride to Hell, Prisoner of a Dubious Peace, worldwide via Amazon. And there's an ebook edition as well for people who prefer to consume their books in digital format.
Lovely. Hurry up. I think you have to always add to the end of that. Paul, I mean, it's an absolute pleasure having you on the show. That goes without saying. It was delightful to meet you at the stall a month or so ago as well. We had a lovely chat then, and since then I've been really looking forward to finishing the book and having you on the show to talk about it. Before we get into, you know, giving us a bit of a précis of what it's about, I'd like to tease the listener, really. But I was intrigued reading the book that you grew up in a place, you know, literally four doors away from, you know, where I lived in London for a very little while. But actually, it's hugely important to me because, you know, when I lived in Lots Road, it got me into Chelsea in a way that hitherto I'd never really found. I mean, I didn't grow up in a Chelsea family, didn't grow up in living in London. So, you know, I was never a very good supporter at all, more of a vicarious armchair supporter, really. But I lived in Lots Road for a couple of years, and if I didn't go to a game, you know, I could sit on the Carsey or have a bath and listen to the crowd going, Chelsea, 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 which seems silly, but for me, it was massive, actually. So I was massively intrigued with the fact your family actually grew up in Lots Road. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, my family, one side of my family come from Sands End, just over the creek. The other side of the family come, my grand side of the family, were all born in Lots Road. My dad, my brother, my nan were all born in Lots Road. I was the firstborn. I was born in St. Stephen's, which is now known as the Chelsea and Westminster. And basically, we just grew up in the area. Me and my brother's Phil. He now lives up in Worcester, up near Worcester with my dad. You know, Chelsea, since it all started. I mean, I can remember the 67 final when, you know, we hadn't been to Wembley for years and all the streets around the area got all the flag, all the curbs got painted blue and white. And the whole area was just blue and white. There was a bus that left from Maggie Mons, which was the Greasy Spoon in Lots Road. And they all went up to Wembley on an open top bus. And we watched it on the telly in Lots Road. And that was the 67 final. And, you know, it's been that way ever since. You know, I must be honest and say I had a feeling that Tottenham were going to beat us in the 67 final, but my brother was staunch. But unfortunately, I was correct. And we've just been at Chelsea. I mean, we were there right through the late 70s, early 80s, and then we sort of moved away. And the closeness that we shared about the club. Now my brother, he went to New Zealand. He's now back in this country, but he got very used to watching Chelsea on the TV. And so he's quite happy with that. I'm the one with the season ticket. And myself and my father lament quite a lot this season about our performances or our disappointing substitutions, let's say.
Well, absolutely, Paul. I mean, it's good to remind people that, you know, Chelsea was actually a very Chelsea area. Of course, Alan Hudson lived around the corner from when you would have been there, I'm sure. It almost seems a bit, you know, trivial to talk about Chelsea in the context of what we're going to talk about today, because, you know, your book is in many ways a horrific story. But of course, you know, as Marco alluded to, and I know, having read it, that there are strands of Chelsea running through as an undercurrent almost, actually. It's kind of, I don't know how to describe it really. It kind of pops up like a little bloke popping its head around the door going, yeah, I'm still here occasionally. And it made me chuckle with a few mentions that you go from some horrific stuff and then suddenly Chelsea comes in. Can you set the scene for us a little bit? Just explain, you know, just explain kind of what happened. I mean, you were working abroad, weren't you? You were working in Kuwait as a chef, and you were off to go and see a mate who worked, I think, near the Iraqi border. And then it all went horribly Pete Tong, didn't it?
Yeah. Actually, I was in catering management by that time. I was off the tools. And I was working on a contract where the firefighters were putting out the oil well fires that the Iraqis had started after the first Gulf War in 91, 92. So when that ended, they put them out incredibly quickly. I was put onto another contract in a town called Jara, which is about 70 clicks, kilometres, northwest of Kuwait City. And I was driving backwards and forwards four and five times a day. It was starting to really get on my nerves. I never got stopped at any of the checkpoints. They just waved me through. I was seen up and down the road so often. So on this particular day, I went to get some bread. We used about 20 loaves of European style bread. And there was a fault with the machine and it wasn't available. So I thought to myself, I've either got to drive back to where I was living in a place called Latifa Towers, or I thought I can spend 5 hours, which was the time I had to waste, going up and seeing a mate of mine called Mike Walsh that I'd worked with in Algeria. So I went up to see him, and I was stopped about three times on the road going up. And the scene from the Hurt Locker, where he comes up to the brow of a sand dune and looks down upon this scene of destruction. I drove through the middle of that. It was quite terrifying. You know, there were just missiles and bunches of boxes of grenades and rocket launchers. It was just like a scene from a war film. And I approached three or four checkpoints, and the last one said to me, don't turn left or right. Well, the road went up and then it just disappeared, and it turned into like hardcore, like sand and rubble. And I thought, well, I'm not driving across that because there's an awful lot of things that haven't gone bang in Kuwait at the moment. So I'm not going to drive off of the blacktop. So the blacktop turned to the left. I turned with it. And then about half a kilometre on, there were two signs, and one said to a town in northern Kuwait, and one said to the United Nations Iraq Kuwait Observation Mission. It said it was that way. So I followed the signs that it sent me. It turned me to my left, and I passed between well, what I can only describe as the detritus of hundreds of boats. It was a boatyard, and I could see in the distance, I could see Derek. So I knew I was very close to the Gulf, which I hadn't been for quite a while, you know, since I'd left home that morning. So I'd come sort of up and gone around. And then I drove onto this roundabout, and one sign said the HQ that way, and another one said to the camp. And I thought, well, I don't want to be seen wandering around the camp, so I'll go to the HQ. So I followed the sign to the HQ, and there was a strange, there was like an Iraqi, sorry, there was an Arabic style arch. And on the top of the arch was this flag. And I thought, that's strange. That looks right, but I know there's something wrong with it. And I had on the dashboard of the vehicle, there was a Union Jack on a stick, and it was shoved into the dashboard. And as I climbed out of the vehicle to go and ask these soldiers, all these soldiers all swung their arms towards me and started, you know, posturing. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. And then it suddenly hit me. The flag was the Iraqi flag. And I thought, right, well, I'm in Kuwait. I work in Kuwait. That's the border with Iraq. So I've just got to, if you like, front this out. So I went up to this sergeant who looked like one of the sergeants, one of the, off of an old American comedy. You know, there was Stalag Luft 17, and there was this big, he wasn't well-dressed. He looked very untidy, very scruffy. And he said, you know, I explained to him in Pidgin Arabic that I was going to see a friend who was working for the Iraq-Kuwait observation mission. And he said, hey, my Mishgila, yes, no problem. Get in the vehicle, get in the Sierra. So I got into the car, and as I jumped out, I pulled the Union Jack out of the dashboard, because I thought, I don't want to antagonize these blokes. He gets in beside me and he goes, Rua, go. And he points towards Iraq. And I said, no. Hada Mishgila, that's a problem. That's Iraq. I work in Kuwait. So he went, Rua. And this must have happened 4 or 5 times. Go, no, go, no. And then he pulled his gun out. And so I just gunned it. I just hit the accelerator, drove across the border, and it turned into one of those situations where I thought, I've just got to try and ingratiate myself with these guys, because I'm now under their control. And so I was taken into a room, and then it was, as he took me into the room, I then realized what the problem was, because the vehicle I was driving was registered in Saudi, and they believed that I had driven from Saudi Arabia through Kuwait, and then I'd got to the Iraqi border.
Yeah, I mean, just to put this in context for people, this is in kind of, it was in 1992, so the first Gulf War had not long finished, where, of course, America and the British, you know, came to the aid of Kuwait because Iraq had invaded Kuwait. But, of course, the Saudis had been very instrumental in that, because they'd provided a lot of, I mean, Riyadh was a massive air base for us, wasn't it, during the war. So the appearance of a Brit in Iraq I hesitate to use this metaphor, but I'm going to use it anyway, like a pork chop in a synagogue. It was not going to go down very, very well. What strikes me, I mean, this is really the start of the book, isn't it? And from there, you basically, this is your ride to hell. This is the 18 months of hell. Because, and what struck me most about the book, Paul, was almost, I mean, you mention it a lot, actually. You call it naivety, but in a way, I would call it innocence, you know. And I think for me, the crux of the book rests on a fascinating premise. I mean, you could call it British exceptionalism, but I would actually call it British naivety. When we go abroad as Brits, we don't think anything bad can happen to us. And we have this kind of strange furrow on our brow when people say, well, no, actually, you're in real trouble. Well, of course I'm not. I'm British. You know, I'll give you a stupid example that pales into insignificance compared to your story. But I remember being in Canada, and we were driving back across the border to the States. Now, as you know, America's actually quite a nasty place to get in and out of, actually. The border guards there are horrible. And we're faced with, like, you know, the motorway, and it's got, like, 8 lanes at the border control. And I see a lane on the right where which has less cars in it. And being impatient, I thought, well, I'm going to go down that one. Of course, I wasn't allowed down that one. And I was about to be in serious trouble. And the border guard's looking at me with massive malicious intent. I've got the wife in the car. And I just looked, I'm sorry, mate, I'm British. And he kind of just looked at me, rolled his eyes, and said, go on. And I think we have that attitude. And it seemed to me that throughout the book, you know, you kind of go through so many hurdles. And it's like, this can't be happening to me. This is all going to work out. This is all going to be fine. You know, this is nuts. I'm innocent. I've not done anything wrong. And, you know, I'll get out of this mess. And, of course, the absolute opposite happens every time. And I think that's the thing that astonishes me about the book. Real wake-up call for anybody, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is it. You know, you go abroad, you work abroad. And I'd by this time, I'd been doing it 7 or 8 years. And I got quite used to, I wouldn't say being... the odd man out, but certainly being a Brit abroad, you know, I was used to, you know, coming home after 3 months. I was used to working away, and I built up a lifestyle around that. But what happened to me? It's almost like every time I thought, right, this is going to be over now, we went in the other direction. Every time I thought there's an end in sight here. And this is going to come to an end fairly soon. Like, for example, I talk about it in the book. I was held in a number of locations in Basra while they were deciding what to do with me. And they took me to the Igama office, which is an office about getting passes to travel back to Kuwait. And when I'm at the Igama office, rather than taking me back to Kuwait, they send me back to a police station. At the police station, I hear people being tortured. I hear people being, I hear women being assaulted. I mean, I use the word assaulted. I think that these women were being raped. It was unbelievable. But then the next day, they took me back to where I'd been, and I thought, all right, this is great. I'm back here now. And I saw the guy who took me to the office, and I thought, right, this is all going to finish now, and I'll be going back to Safran and Kuwait. The next thing is, three guys come up to me and say, how would you like to go to Baghdad? And I said, no, thank you very much. I'll go to Safran. I'll go back over the border in the other direction, please. And he said, no, our orders are to take you to Baghdad. And, you know, I said innocently, I said, how far's that? And he went, 800 kilometers. And I thought, well, I'm sort of 80 kilometers in trouble now. I'm going to be a whole lot more when I'm 880 kilometers into the country. And it was, you know, when they drove me, they drove me on a quiet back road. And I had visions of ended up in the desert, very quiet, you know. The whole thing was something I couldn't understand. And as I say at one point in the book, these, you know, I call them a rather nasty name, but I say they basically think they've got James Bond in a T-shirt, because as you see, I wear T-shirts.
Well, that was the thing, isn't it? Because they were labouring under the illusion that you were a spy. That you were spying for the British or the Saudis, when actually the reality, of course, is that you're working as a catering manager and you got lost. But they wouldn't accept it, would they? And I think this is another thing that we, perhaps as British, are under a misapprehension, that the people will understand this and that justice and truth will prevail, when actually in a lot of countries that's far from it. And actually, the other thing that came across, the deeper one gets into the book, you suddenly realise that actually, you're not a criminal. You're a political prisoner, really, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, they started asking, once they put me through the you know, people say, oh, did when you went to court, did you have a lawyer? I never spoke to anyone about my situation. They thrust me into this court. There was one guy over here on my right who was very, very quiet. There was one guy over here on my left. I was in a box facing these three judges, And the guy on the left is assassinating my character, I imagine, in Arabic. I don't understand what's being said. They asked me if I was guilty of illegal entry. I said, no, I was brought over the border at gunpoint. And then they say, no, but did you come over the border? And I said, yeah, I had to say yes. And he starts screaming at me, this head judge. And he starts saying, you know, he said to me, oh, and how long do you think we can give you? And I'd been told that the sentence for illegal entry was 5 years and 1 month. So I said, 5 years and 1 month. And he goes, no. This is a military tribunal. We can sentence you to life. But because we're nice, because this is Iraq and we're very reasonable, we'll give you 7 years. And the rest is just a dream. I'm walking down this corridor and it's like, you know, these strange dreamlike situations where the room seems to go on for about 1,000 miles. That's all this. I was walking down the corridor with this guy who'd taken me to court. And he's going, oh, we're very sorry. We didn't expect this. And I can't hear anything but this like rushing sound and him occasionally twittering on. And each and every time that I think, right, now, at least I'm sentenced. Now I can get to the jail because everyone's telling me how marvelous Abu Ghraib it's got with all these facilities. By the time I get to Abu Ghraib, I suddenly realize it's a hellhole. It's... You can't even describe conditions. I mean, I had food. They poured water through a set of bars to give us water to drink when I was in the reception at Abu Ghraib before I got transferred to the foreign section, because Abu Ghraib, it had a foreign section, it had a female section, it had a political section, it had the Iraqi section, and all these were individual prisons within another compound. It was a huge, huge compound. And I got driven around it at sometimes when I was lucky. Most of the time I had to march between our section, the foreigner section, and the Iraqi main section. It was very unpleasant. And it's something that we were just talking, Mark and myself. It's 30 years ago this year. And sometimes it does seem like 30 years ago. And then all of a sudden, something will happen and it's very much in your face. And it's things like when I was watching that film, The Hurt Locker, that blew my mind. That scene where he hits the top of the sand dune and he looks down on the detritus of war, you know, that really upset me. But it's very difficult to explain. It's very difficult to say, oh yeah, I've got PTSD and everyone knows what I'm talking about. It's almost like over the years I've got better at dealing with it, but unfortunately there are some things that still set me off.
Yeah,
I really don't cope well with stress anymore.
Well, I think having, and I mean, you know, I honestly go out and read this book. It is horrific. It is really horrific. I mean, do you know what? Talking of films, actually, Paul and Mark, and you mention it in the book, funnily enough. I was thinking about it, and then lo and behold, it appears on the page. But it reminded me of Midnight Express, in a way. You know, I mean, it's bad enough being incarcerated, and you write an immensely eloquent passage on really the most insidious thing about prison. I mean, you know, we have the ability to, and you mentioned this, we have the ability as human beings to adapt and survive under the most appalling conditions which you faced. But actually the biggest issue is having your freedom taken away. So that's bad enough in any prison. But to do it in an environment like that, where you're hated because you're British, because of the war, and you don't speak the language, you don't know what's going on, the fear that provokes, it's quite, read this book, it will blow your mind. It's horrific, Marco, isn't it?
Yeah, no, what I was going to say, I think the as Paul's sort of ride to hell, as he goes on this journey, as you turn the pages of the book, you're presented with Paul describing a situation with some options, and you're thinking, no, that doesn't really sound like a good idea, Paul. And it's just a catalogue of progressive misfortune, which you know, there's a dark humour to that in itself, which is British, which we've already spoken about. But the horror is very present. You know, the interrogations, the fear that brings, the loneliness, the boredom, being isolated from family, all of those things that, you know, the kind of pieces of the jigsaw of you know, the portrait of the story that we see here, you know, and then it kind of gets to a point where, you know, and Paul can talk about it, where there is communication with Blighty, and you know, the Chelsea connection comes into play, and the whole thing about this is, it was 30 years ago, but that was a period with no social media. Basically, we got news presented to us in newspapers, on the wireless, or on TV, and it's basically what people want you to see, hear, or read. So, you know, I think if Paul had been in this situation today, you know, there'd have been one of those petitions like there was to sack Potter, which had 50,000 signatures after a day. The pressure on the government would have been immense today, but it was, and I'm sure Paul can go into this now, but it was very, very different in you know, with the circumstances that he was having to deal with. Very effectively, he was a human shield.
You, Marco, do you know what? I reading it, you know, this week, I was thinking exactly the same, because one of the things that struck me, and again, this is the whole kind of British exceptionalism stroke naivety that we have. You're sitting there reading the book, going, why the fuck is nobody saying anything? Why aren't the government getting involved? Why aren't the press getting, what's happening? He's just like there on his own and nobody gives a shit. What's going on? And I did think that. I thought this would not happen now, you know, because of social media. There would be campaigns. It would just really kick off. And I think it would be hard to ignore and leave in the bottom drawer of some faceless civil servant's desk in Whitehall. You know, it just wouldn't happen. It's quite staggering. I mean, this is just a short sentence, really, I picked out from the book, Paul, but it seems to sum it up, really, what you faced while you were there. A litany of mental torture, deprivation, and high farce. It's the farce was the intrigue, because you do read the book, you're thinking, that's mad. How can that happen? And it, you know, I'd love you to comment on, but there's just one other thing that really also resonated with me, and I think, you know, I think it goes through the book. You were very lucky. You weren't really physically assaulted. And I think most people in that situation would be very fearful of that, knowing how brutal the Iraqi regime was and how bullying it was. And you do describe other people who got the shit kicked out of them, frankly. But actually, it's the mental torture, I think, that is more insidious. And the one thing that really struck me was when they took everything off you. You know, all your possessions, but your wedding rings as well, and things like that. And so you were absolutely naked. And I just thought, you can't think of a more effective way than taking somebody's identity away when you take everything away from them and they're left with nothing. And I just thought that was awful. But as Marco suggests, actually, it does get a little bit better, and you start getting connection with the outside world. And who knew that Paddy Feeney would be in some way a mental salvation?
Yeah. Paddy Feeney became a go-between. There was one situation that happened when Julia came to visit me. Julia's my wife. And she went back, and no one could tell me for about 3 or 4 weeks if she got back to London okay, or was she? And the rumor was, oh, she also came in on the incorrect visa. She can be put away in prison for 7 years, the same as you. Blah blah. And this is like turning me over and inside out. And then basically, I got Paddy Feeney, or I asked if she could tell Paddy Feeney could tell me when, because she came three or four times to see me, when she got back. And Paddy Feeney was the person who said yes. And you know,
we should say who Paddy Feeney is, really, for those of us who are not the same age as we are.
Yeah, Paddy Feeney was the presenter of Sports World on Saturday, and he very, very kindly and regularly mentioned me during his broadcast. But he especially said, oh, I've got a message for Paul Ryde from Julie, so I would know that she's back in the UK safe, because no one could tell me. I mean, no one, including the British Foreign Office. And then I found out, there was some person from the Foreign Office who'd been speaking to her the day after she got back to the UK. But no one thought it was like a need to know basis. Oh, and the bloke who's being held hostage, he doesn't need to know. It was that sort of stuff that was really difficult to live with, because we live in an information world. People find out things that go on the other side of the world instantly, messages and television and news. And there I was, sat thousands of miles away from everyone I knew and everyone that I cared about and hopefully cared about me, but I couldn't find out any information. And it was this lack of information. And the Iraqis, rather than tell you nothing, they would tell you anything. Oh, yeah, yeah. Is Madam, you know, that he would say to me, the guy from the Mukhabarat, are the Iraqi secret police, and I was interrogated by them on about four occasions. He would say to me, where is Madam Julie? Because they called Julie Madam Julie. That was all they ever referred to her as. I said, I'm in prison. I said, I'm sat here in Abu Ghraib. How the hell do I know where my wife is? Oh, we hear she is in Baghdad. I said, great. Would you like to see her? He says. I said, yeah, please. If she's in Baghdad, yes, please, I'd like to see her. Oh, we'll see if we can arrange this. And it was this sort of cat and mouse teasing all the time, sort of trying to... It was almost like, as I've described it to friends that I spoken to about this, I say, I was very lucky. I was never tortured. And then I say, but why would I be? I basically was a nice cream cake that they put in the window to say, we've got your cream cake. Do you want your cream cake back? And there's no point in smashing up the cream cake, because then no one's going to want to buy it. You know, so I was held and sort of put in the window for them to buy. First of all, they wanted the sanctions lifted. Then they wanted £6 million worth of drugs, you know, medical drugs, not...
You know. Something else to get in trouble.
Medical supplies rather than, you know, hash and coke. Mind you, a bit of crack might have made a bit of a bit of a positive to some of them that I was ill with. But it was this sort of teasing and all the time, well, we know this, you don't know this, but we're going to tell you a part of it. And, you know, I started making, I got bread and yeast brought into me. Julie sent it into me, and I started making bread rolls. And they went, oh, this is about a year after they'd been holding me. And they went, oh, now we believe you're a chef. And I'm thinking, well, I was never much of a chef, you know, but, you know, what did they think I was? You know, it was bizarre, because everything they said to me, I mean, the British government employed a guy called Khaled Jurjis. Now, Khaled Jurjis was absolutely one of the worst things that happened to me, because he was meant to be my lawyer, being paid for by the British government, although they didn't pay for him, as far as I know, and he was then coming after me. So I got money transferred into me so I could pay him in Iraqi dinars, which was cheaper. We could get him on the black market. But it was this situation where the officials in Whitehall actually employed this guy who was, in my mind, he was in cahoots. He was hand in glove with the Mukhabarat. And, he called me into the office, or they called me into the office. Abu Athir, he was the Mukhabarat guy, and Khaled Jurjis. They called me into the office, and Khaled Jurjis says, do you remember when you, because I worked, when the Gulf War first started, I was working as a chef at the Ministry of Defence. And I was at the Ministry of Defence the first night the Gulf War started. And Khaled Jurjis says to me in the middle of Abu Ghraib prison, he says, Do you remember when you went into the Ministry of Defence and that door you went through? And I'm thinking, what's the matter with you, crazy sod? You know, why are you talking about this? Why are you putting me in this invidious position? Because you're insinuating that I know something more than I do. I would go into the MOD, I would go down to the kitchen, and I would come out of the kitchen and go out of the MOD. I saw nothing. In actual fact, people would come to me while I was working in the MOD and say, what's happening? Because I had more news on the radio than they had on the official lines back in and out, because it, you know, the whole thing was so secret. And it's things like that, you know, it's basically when you think, yeah, I'm going to be all right now, I can cope with this. There was this awful mechanism that seemed to sort of, whenever everything was going well, there'd be something that Khaled Georges or someone else would do, which would blow the whole thing wide open again. And you think, I'm never going to get out of here if these fools don't stop playing like this.
Yeah. It seems to me to be very much part of the process and the kind of the gaslighting and ratcheting it up. Eventually, you know, you do get access to. There's a lovely passage where I think this is before you're in Abu Ghraib, but you managed to catch Chelsea losing 3-2 to Norwich, which is enough to piss most people off, but. But you do get a radio in the end, and Paddy Feeney, as you said, who was the sports presenter on Sports World for the BBC World Service, kind of keeps you. I mean, I can't think of anything more awful than being that disconnected from everything. That would sorely test my mental health. So I'm just kind of thinking, did that help? You know, in a way. I mean, you know, it does seem trivial to talk about Chelsea in some respects, but. You know, setting this in context, this is the 92-93 season, isn't it? And the 93-94 season, which was pretty dire for Chelsea, as I recall. So I'm kind of half of me saying, you know, that connection might have really helped you kind of get through it. But on the other hand, I'm thinking it might have made you feel worse. But what was it, Paul?
Cheech.
JK. In all the years you've been following Chelsea, you hardly ever miss a match, home or away. But how would you feel if you couldn't be there and it's not on TV?
Oh, Chich, I'd be bereft, inconsolable. The thought of missing my beloved Blue Boys live, it's all too much.
I know, JK, I know. It's all a bit too much, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, panic not. NordVPN have come to the rescue.
They have?
Yep. NordVPN allows us to watch any match, even if it's not on live TV here.
They do?
Yeah, they do. With just one click, they switch your virtual location to a country which is showing the match, and they act as your cyber bodyguard whilst online, protecting your personal data and sensitive info like card details and passwords.
Oh, wow. Great. But yeah, I bet that'll cost me a fortune.
Actually, JK, it's only the price of a cup of coffee per month, and you can use your account across 6 devices. It's a bargain, JK, and best of all, no more tears for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, NordVPN. I'm so happy. I could cry. Where do I sign up, Jinj?
Well, to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/ChelseaFancast. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee, and you'll help support the Chelsea Fancast. The link is in the podcast episode description box. Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18+, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Real fans, real opinions.
I'm Jason Cundy and you're listening to the Chelsea Football Fancast. Proper Chelsea.
Footballfancast.com.
No, I mean, it was really fantastic because Ken Bates, who was the chairman of the club at the time, made an announcement in the club magazine and in a couple of programmes that he asked Chelsea supporters to flood the Iraqi postal system with messages of support and letters and all that. And I got thousands of things. I was replying on little slips of paper because basically I didn't have any paper and I was borrowing this paper. So I reply on tiny little slips of paper. But the support was fantastic. You know, people would tell me, people would tell me all sorts of things. You know, it was almost like I was part of their family and they discussed, what was going on at home, and they'd give me little stories and vignettes that were happening in their life. And it really sort of made me feel close to home. It certainly made me feel closer to my Chelsea family at Stamford Bridge. But by the same token, as much as I got, I'm sure there was an equal, if not more, a greater amount, which I never got, because things turned up to me and envelopes were ripped open, half the letters were missing, half, inserts, oh, did you like that thing we sent you? I had to say, I'm sorry, I never received anything. If it wasn't brought in officially by the Russians, who represented the British government, because there was no British embassy in Baghdad at the time, so a guy called Gleb Desietnikov came twice a month on the 2nd and the 20th and saw us. If he didn't bring it into us, we didn't get it. And so, some months we'd have a surfeit of mail, there'd be a great big pile. Other months, oh, we haven't been to Amman and collected the mail from the British Embassy in Amman in Jordan, so we haven't got anything for you this month. So it was very much hit and miss. I could be flooded with 200 or 300 pieces of mail in one session, and then I might not get any for 6 weeks. So I started eking out my replies, but it really was it was one of those situations where, without the support of those people, without the support of people who knew about my club, who knew things that I couldn't know because I was locked away, thousands of miles away, that was a bridge that really kept me looking forward. I will get out. It actually was in Abu Ghraib. It was Eurosport, I think. It was the only time I saw any of Chelsea. And all I saw was Dave Besant make an arch over the ball, and the ball trickled underneath him. We'd gone 2-0 in front and we lost it 3-2. And it was just, I thought, oh my God, here I am, thousands of miles away, and the boys can't even get it right the one time I see him on the TV.
I know, that thought occurred to me when I read it, actually. You wrote to Ken Bates as well, didn't you?
I wrote to all sorts of people. I wrote to Ken Bates, I wrote to John Major. I wrote to everyone who sent me any mail. And if anyone sent me mail that I didn't reply to, it's because I never got it. And that is, that is the only reason I didn't reply to any piece of mail, is because it just never turned up. But I wrote to Ken Bates, and I wrote a couple of times to the Chelsea, I can't think what it was called at the time, but the newspaper. We had a newspaper at the time.
Onside, wasn't it?
Was yeah. Onside.
Yeah. I wrote to them a couple of times, and my letters featured a couple of times in Onside. And that was very, very good at a club, because, as happened when I eventually did get back, I didn't make myself very popular in the dressing room, because basically all I'd got was the negative side of the thing from everyone who was writing to me saying, oh, we've lost this and we've lost that and things are going from bad to worse and blah, blah, blah. And of course, I've come out of custody on the Friday afternoon, and on the Saturday, at 3 o'clock, I'm at Stamford Bridge. And of course, my head is swimming. So I've said some very undiplomatic things in the dressing room. Oh, Steen, you're the guy that's been signed and you haven't scored for 7 weeks. And I'm going, you'll get it right, mate. You'll be all right. Unfortunately, he did. But I don't know if he ever, I was ever seen as the catalyst of his 7 goals in a row. I was seen as the guy.
I think you should take it, Paul.
I probably will. But I think actually I was seen as the guy who come in with you know, and made some stupid comments. So I thought, well, you know, I remember when actually when Texas, when Dennis got locked up and he said, oh, the horror of the door closing behind me. And I thought, yeah, let's have that 18 months worth, yeah. Dennis. Then you know that you're not sort
in
of
Iraq.
Yeah. But it's things like that, you know, people go, oh, my lifespan before me when the door shut behind me. And I'm thinking, yeah, it did. But, you know, it's like when I hear people on the telly now and they go, oh, I haven't seen my wife and children for 3 weeks. And you think, 3 weeks? You know, and it seems very unfair of me to judge other people. But it reminds me of what I lost.
Yeah.
You know, when people say, oh, 3 weeks, 5 weeks, 2 months, you think, yeah, well, times 10.
I mean, you know, you have, I mean, we'll touch on this later, but I mean, you have an absolutely justifiable and righteousness to be as pissed off, bitter, twisted and angry as anybody I've ever met. So I wouldn't hold a little bit of judgment against you. Marco, I mean, it's interesting hearing Paul talking about the Chelsea element and the number of supporters that wrote him. I didn't know that Bates had done that, actually. Dear old Ken, he's having a good week, isn't he? That interview he did with the Blueprint Boys, he's coming out actually as a far cuddlier Captain Birdseye than many of us might have thought. But do you remember around that time, you know, were you aware of Paul's plight, you know, as a
Yeah, no, obviously read about it in Onside, the Chelsea Independent, the forerunner of CFC UK, was on the streets, and that had featured a couple of articles in there. And, you know, Bates actually encouraged everyone to write to Paul. And I feel bad because I didn't. Yeah, but I think I was.
Nor did I, and I'm very sorry now.
Taking too many drugs at that time.
I was pretending I didn't like football because I just met my future wife, Paul. What can I say?
You know, these are the breaks, aren't they? But it was really good. And to be honest with you, another thing that I don't know if everyone is aware of, when Ken Bates organised a collection. He organised a collection at Stamford Bridge, and Julie was given, I believe, over £2,500. You know, and that sort of generosity by ordinary people was what kept her, in, you know, able to go on, because there were all sorts of things that I didn't realise. The government, I thought the government were posting my mail. Julie was posting my mail. I wrote hundreds of letters, and she paid for the post for all of them. And it was the generosity of people with collections like Chelsea organised that kept her able to keep going.
Yeah, good old Bates. He liked a collection, didn't he? In more ways than one. But there we go. Anyway, look, eventually you get out. Bizarrely, in some respects, due to the largesse of Sir Edward Heath. But anyway, you get out of prison finally, and you come home. And of course, most people would have thought, brilliant, Paul's back, life gets back to normal, it's all going to be great. Not necessarily the case, was it, Paul?
Unfortunately not. What I didn't realise was I'd already slipped into a psychotic state. I wasn't aware of what was going on. I thought, you know, lots of things that should have been very good for me were actually very difficult. The company I worked for had reduced my salary once I'd been captured and taken over the border. They reduced my salary to 50% of what it was. Julie wasn't able to live on that. And when I got back, they basically said, we're going to pay you 50% of your salary for the next 3 months, and then you're on your own. So I was paid until February 2004. And then basically I had to go back to work. What I didn't realise was, because so much of my existence, if you like, in Abu Ghraib and in Iraq had centred around food and keeping myself fit and alive, I'd got into a bit of a mental fugue about preparation of food. And it was just something I didn't want to do anymore. And unfortunately, if you've been a chef, I think most people know that if you're a chef, you are a chef. I mean, we were flown back by the generosity of Sir Richard Branson. He actually sent a jet out there, and we came back on this jet. There was just us and a few people that Sir Edward Heath allowed to get on the plane, journalists of his liking. So we fly back in. We stopped at Bari to refuel. We fly back in to Gatwick. And then he says to me very generously, if you need some help, get in touch with me. So I get in touch with his personal assistant. And his personal assistant says, yes, send me a CV. I'll pass it to our catering department. And I'm thinking, you don't understand. I don't want to do catering anymore. I can't. It's like this mental thing that's freaking me out. And that was part of the problem, because I'd only ever, as in a working sense, been a chef. It was proven impossible to move away from. And basically, I went back to university and got the education I didn't get as a 16-year-old, because that was basically why I became a chef, because I had no qualifications to do anything else. And I retrained, got myself a degree, and then went out and did a teaching, PGCE, Postgraduate Certificate of Education. But all the time, you know, I'm trying to do things in the right way, and Iraq is still tugging at me, and it's still tugging at me. I did loads and loads and loads of different types of psychological counselling. There was a rapid eye movement where someone waved a pencil in front of me.
EMDR.
I believe that's what it's. Yeah,
it's designed to help people with trauma. So it would have, yeah.
I think it's worth, I mean, obviously it's up to Paul if he wants to talk about this, but when Paul returns to the UK, you know, his life does take a far darker turn. I mean, you don't think it can get any worse than what he's experiencing in Iraq, in isolation. You know, your life pretty much unravels, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, those steps where he builds his life back together, does the college degree and goes on to do the work that he does now, sort of getting the gap in between there is truly, you know, traumatic for Paul.
Well, the situation was I came back and I was just angry all the time. I was on the edge of a minor explosion every waking minute of the day. And Julie, quite rightly, you know, she sacked me. She kicked me to the curb. I cannot blame her one iota. She was dead right to do it. And she and William went off and left me. And I thought, right, well, that's the only thing that got me through Iraq. It was Julie and William. And I'm thinking to myself, right, well, there's nothing left, so I'm just going to take my own life. And I tried to overdose. I took every tablet I could, I had in the house. I drank a bottle of brandy. I washed it down with half a bottle of Southern Comfort. I was in a real mess. And then basically I woke up the next day and I thought, why can't I sort of stop this torture, you know? And I then tried to create some smoke to asphyxiate myself, and I was too good. The old pyromania took over and I was too good. And the flames did start licking around the bed. And I thought, oh, I don't want to burn. I don't want that sort of pain. I just want to drift away nice and peaceful. And that's when the police got involved and they said, yeah, we're going to have to arrest you for your own protection. So this really nice detective constable, a guy called DC Franks, lovely bloke, he arrested me and he said, this is for your own protection. And then the Crown Prosecution Service got involved and they said, no, he's a criminal and we're going to take him to court and we're going to prosecute him for arson. And I'd actually run from Palmerston Road across Forest Road to the fire station in my skiddies, in my wife fronts. That was all I had on. And they came to my house, and upstairs in this flat, are still records that were in the same room. So that's how little damage it caused. Those records are still upstairs and they still play fine. And it was thanks to the fireman who came across double quick and just put the fire out. But it involved an insurance claim and they wouldn't deal with me because they said, you know, he's off his head. So they would only deal with Julie. And that was another thing that I felt isolated and I felt, you know, victimized and belittled. And all this sort of stuff that I should have been better able to handle, I just couldn't handle in any way, shape or form. And as Mark rightly points out, you know, I made some terrible decisions and I made some decisions based on the fact that, you know, I was very ill. I was mentally ill. I had a breakdown. And then once they decided, right, they said to me, right, now at Colt, you can either go to Pentonville or you can go to Claybury. Now, Claybury is a huge mental hospital near Wood Green. Woodford Bridge in on the borders of Essex. And I said, I don't mind, you know, roughy tufty. I said, I don't mind. Put me in Pentonville. I can cope. And they went, no. We think you will be better off and we'll be easier to get in touch with at Claybury. So I went to Claybury. Trouble is that also now gives me a psychiatric record that means when I come out of there, I eventually, they take me backwards and forwards between Claybury and Waltham Forest Magistrates Court. And each and every time they do it, I have to run the gauntlet of the media. And in the last time I actually went to Colt, I made a one-fingered obscene gesture towards the TV camera. And in the evening, on London news, they went, should Paul Ryan be shown clemency? You know, as if an obscene...
Why were the media involved? Is it because, obviously, you know, because of what had happened to you in Iraq, people, you know, that you were on the media's conscience, so you then became a story, right? Is that why they're involved?
Yeah, exactly that. The only reason they were involved is because they can then say, oh, prisoner hostage from Iraq, you know, loses the plot, tries to kill himself and everyone on these terrace. And the BBC, actually, the day I went to Colt, they took me to the Old Bailey. They said, "Yes, we can't deal with this at Waltham Forest. We're gonna pass this up to the Central Criminal Court." And I'm thinking, Central Criminal Court. So then it dawned on me, that's the Old Bailey. They think they've got hold of some kind of major league villain here, you know. And then they take me to the Old Bailey. I am backwards and forwards with a barrister. That cost me a lot of money. And I eventually, on the day of the court hearing at the Old Bailey, the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, offered no evidence. But I still had to go and appear at the Old Bailey. And on the very morning of that case, the BBC show a picture of a house that's burnt out. Out, it's gutted. There's smoke pouring out of windows. There's windows are smashed in.
Not your house.
Not my house. And I'm this is another thing where I'm thinking, Christ, these people are out to get me. You know, the paranoia really kicked in. And it was only the fact that my dad was there and my MP, Neil Gerrard, his personal assistant, she was there and they were coming with me to the court. And they both sort of calmed me down a bit. But I had really lost my mind, you know, before appearing later that day at the Old Bailey, because the BBC just put on a burnt-out house and said, this is Paul Ryan's drum. And it wasn't.
Unbelievable. I'm a psychotherapist in my day job, so it just staggers me that... that you weren't looked after better, actually, given all of that and given what you'd gone through. I mean, I remember when we talked to the stall, you said you did get a lot of help. I'm thinking not at this stage, because, I mean, you know, Claybury was a psychiatric hospital. You were in there because they were trying to stitch you up for attempted arson, I presume. But did you get help after this?
Yeah, it was arranged by my MP's personal assistant. She got me in and paid for me to have a therapy at a place called Ticehurst House. And this was the place, these were the people that had actually dealt with Terry Waite and John McCarthy. And I went there and I had a two-week sort of in-house therapy. There were four of us. And basically they made me understand that my problem with the sort of the PTSD, it wasn't what I had, but it was mentally what I felt I'd lost. And for me, it was the loss of being able to earn a living. It was a complete, I mean, the therapy there, the treatment there was absolutely brilliant, and I can't thank them enough. But based on my experience, Neil Gerrard, my MP in Walthamstow, actually ran a thing called the Hostage Recovery Bill, and he ran that through the House of Commons, and I believe that is now on the statute books, based on my experience and lack of care and treatment when I first got back, because I basically fell apart. I was in a very bad way, and I'd be the first to admit I was unpleasant. It was difficult for me and difficult for everyone around me. And I still can go off pop, but I tend to go off pop about things that I have no control over, like
Chelsea.
Well, I've often said, you know, in a therapeutic, Marco and I have had long chats about this in the past, the therapeutic, nay, cathartic qualities of Chelsea. And it's almost like it's a lesson in understanding karma in both senses of the word, actually, because we cannot control what happens on that bloody pitch and also off it with the people who run it. And of course, the irony is, as Chelsea supporters, we think we own the club. We think we are the club. We think we control all of it. Bollocks, can we? So I think that's something that kind of resonates. I mean, look, you know, Paul, something that occurs to me, you know, and the relationship really between fear and anger, let alone the relationship between the need to control as well as a way to deal with fear. But it just occurs to me, because, you know, having read the book, you had to keep a lid on so many things whilst you were in Abu Ghraib, that would have, you know, God, if we get, you know, mildly irritated, nay, violent at a Chelsea result, the things that were happening to you in there would have set most people off. But you, for your own self-preservation, had to keep a lid on that. And I know as a therapist that, you know, all emotions are the same. If we try and stick them in a box, they're going to leak out sooner or later. So it comes as no surprise to me, even if one, you know, sets aside the psychotic breakdown, which again I think is completely understandable, and the PTSD, which is completely understandable, just the innate anger that you would have had having been put in that situation for 18 months, completely understandable. And it astonishes me that people just didn't realize that, or help with that, or try and find out what was going on.
I think it's best summed up. I came out of my house in Walthamstow, and I was walking down the road, and this chap, you know, guy of my age, you know, late 20s, early 30s, he said to me, "Oh, you're that guy off the telly. You're the one who was in prison, isn't you?" I said, "Yeah, that's right." He said, "Yeah, you're all right. You're own now. It's all finished, isn't it?" And I went, "Yeah." And my head's thinking, I wish it was. I really wish it was, you know. But unfortunately, that's everyone thinks that the transition is you're in prison, you're in pain, you're out of prison, the pain stops. And I wish that was true. And I'm so sad that I lost so much. I mean, because my world fell apart. I lost the house that, you know, we had to sell the house and split the money up and all this, that and the other. And, you know, basically that was how I came to return to Chelsea, because I said to my nan, I said, "Nan, can I exercise your right to buy your flat?" I said, you know, and she said, "Yeah." And so she exercised her right to buy it. I paid for the purchase of the flat. And basically I sort of lived with her for the last 6 or 7 years of her life. And she was good enough to do that to and for me. And it's sort of given me a restart that I would never have had without her and the opportunity to move back in here.
I think that's a really good point, you know, on on both sides of the coin. You know, you can't turn the clock back. You can't eradicate what happened. You kind of just have to find a way to live with it, really. But also, you know, it's never too late for a restart. Never. And I think, I mean, I've you know, reading the epilogue of the book, there seems to me that seems to have solidified for you in a way. Is that where you are now?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, Julie and I have been back in a relationship for about 10 or 11 years now. You know, it's a long distance one. She lives in Devon. I'm here in Chelsea. And we see each other as often as we can. But it has really damaged my relationship with my son, William, you know, because obviously he experienced a whole load of things. I mean, I remember I was pushing him back. He used to go to a nursery in a place called Hyams Park, which is in between Walthamstow and Chingford. And I used to push him, go up and collect him and push him back in his wheelchair. In his pram. And there were a set of allotments, and over the other side of the allotments there was a tower block. And he went, "Oh, look, Daddy, there's a hotel." Because obviously his experience of tower blocks was the El Rashid Hotel in Baghdad. And it made me understand just how much impact this whole affair had on him. And, you know, our relationship now is really, really difficult, and you know, I'm sure I'm mostly to blame for that. But you know, like you say, you can't turn the clock back.
Well, why are you to blame? It's not your fault you ended up in an Iraqi prison.
No, but it, you know, he was a little boy. He was a little boy, and what happened to him was possibly a result of my actions. You know, by getting locked up, I exposed him to all sorts of things a 2, 3, 4 year old shouldn't be exposed to.
Yeah, understood. I get that. But you, I mean, without sounding trite, you can say that about all of us as parents. You know, you know, that's why I have a job, mate, to be brutally frank. You know, so, I mean, Paul, it is, I mean, look, it's an incredible story. You are an incredible human being to have gone through all that and come out the other side. As I said, I was privileged to meet you at the stall when I did and have a really, you know, decent chat. And as I said, I mean, I think you're a testament to our ability to survive pretty much anything, really. So my hat is massively off to you. And I think, I mean, I can understand, and I didn't really ask you the question, but I would imagine the book was quite a cathartic experience for you. But I think to share something like that so openly can be nothing, because this touches on so many other areas other than, you know, the specifics of being banged up in an Iraqi prison for 18 months. I think it will resonate with anybody, actually.
I've had nothing but nice things said about it. Obviously, the people that have read it thus far, the circulation has been very much family and friends and colleagues at work. Lots of people have said they can hear my voice coming through. And for those that don't know me and read the book, hopefully we'll get an idea that I try to be totally honest. Everything that happens in there is something that happened to me. And I'm going to make a little confession here, is the only things that I didn't write are the actual descriptions of Chelsea football matches. Mark did that because I didn't see anything. All I saw was Besson making an arch over the third goal. And apart from that, the whole thing is true and honest. And you know, some of it is painful. I read some of it now and I think, did that really happen like that? You know, and I've got this, as you say, this attitude of the British overseas. You know, I was waiting for someone to get their shit together and suddenly realised that they couldn't treat an Englishman like this. You know what I mean? It never happened. No, then Sir Edward Heath come out and I had a Chelsea top on and he said, "Take that off. I don't want to be seen as partisan." So I had to take the top off and go out in a T-shirt, which is, you know, but de rigueur for me. But the whole thing was strange. And it was, you know, it was little things. Like I can remember, I should have said nefarious. What I actually said in this interview that I did with this when I was in prison, I said nefarious because I didn't know how to spell it. I knew what it meant, but I didn't know how to pronounce it. So all these little things that sort of happened that I think, that's me looking like a right mug. That's me looking like a complete idiot there, you know. And you set yourself up, you say things and you do things. And I'm just happy. I'm so grateful to Mark because I think the way he has edited it, because it was, as he said, 300,000 words, the way he's edited it, it's a story with a beginning, a middle and an end. And it makes sense. It, you know, whereas a lot of the stuff I'd written, as someone said to me, a friend said to me, Kim, as Kim said to me, it sounds like it was all written by one person now. Because when I would, I mean, it took about 28 years in the writing. And I would write when I was angry. I'd write when I was sad. I'd write when I was depressed. I'd write when I was feeling hard done by. And all these different voices were vying for control. And now, because of the editing and the reading through it and Mark's really generous time and work on the book, I just think it's a lovely read. I'm really proud of it.
Well, it reads really, really well, mate. I mean, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Apart from everything else, it's a cracking read. But has it helped you to get all of that off?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, the reason I started it originally in about 1994... it was a cathartic exercise because all this stuff was just pinging around in my head. And I thought, if I can get it out on paper, then perhaps it will stop just pinging around in my head. And a lot of it did. But unfortunately, there was just so much in there, at, you know, 300,000 words worth. Yeah, well, it was quite difficult to know when I'd said enough about something.
Yeah, well, the cathartic, you know, benefits of writing. I know I know Marco absolutely is a huge supporter of that. It puts my troubles into perspective. When we finish this interview, I've got to write my monthly CFC UK article, which is only going to be 1500 words. So, you know, it pales into significance. Whether it will be cathartic for me, I'm not entirely sure. I'm going to write about Potter, so it might be. You'll never know. The title of which will be
Graham Potter's Blue and White Army, We Hate
Tottenham. No, the title. you know I quite often like to lift a lyric or a title of a song.
Oh yeah.
This one is No Time for Losers.
Oh.
Because we were the champions of the world.
Yeah. I mean, you no one minds three substitutions. Three substitutions is great. We've got enough personnel.
Five's too many, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I mean, we've got the personnel, and it's a good thing we have got the personnel with the injuries we've got. But I don't understand taking three players who were performing well off and replacing them with three, which I consider to be indifferent players across the middle of the park, which never held the middle of the park. It was a very... It was distressing, because I thought we were 10 minutes away from three more points. And thank you very much. You know, we're still sat in 10th and we're still sort of slightly closer to the bottom three than I would be genuinely comfortable with. Yeah.
I just want to wrap it up, Marco. Can you sum the book and Paul up in your own inimitable way?
I think... Paul's a unique person. I think people, you know, obviously I've got to know him well through reading with him to make sure that it's his story and he's happy with it. And I think, you know, it highlights when we, as he rightly said, you know, when you think you're having a bad day, if I think I'm having a bad day, I think of what, you know, particularly in the summer when I was working on this book, because I'd had some issues myself, but they kind of paled into insignificance. So I found it quite therapeutic, actually, to work on this. And I think, in a way, what is nice about the story, as Paul mentioned,
that although, you know, this situation engulfed him and essentially ruined a large part of his life, even though, you know, we're not kids anymore and it was 30 years ago, you know, providing we stay healthy, it's great that Paul's got something now. You know, he's got structure back to his life. He's got a relationship back and he can enjoy, and he's got Chelsea back. That, you know, this kind of is that beginning and middle and an end. And it's just nice. It's not a truly happy ending, but it's a lot better than you think it's going to be. And boy, does he deserve it after the shit that he went through, you know. And it just makes you realize as well, how fortunate we are when we get into, you know, situations with mental health issues, that there's a lot more openness and we can talk about it like we are doing now, because it just wasn't part of everyday life when Paul needed it most. So, you know, that's part of the reason why things got as bad as they did for him. I think what I would say to a reader, if you want to read a story that could be like a film, could be Midnight Express, that's got a bit of Chelsea in it, you won't be disappointed. It's a proper book about a proper fella. And I, you know, that's why I published it. So, yeah, read it. Yeah. You'll love it.
And where can the good denizens of the listeners to this podcast find this book, Mark? How can they buy it?
So it's got a worldwide release through Amazon. So wherever you are in the world, you can just purchase the paperback with local postage rates. We do have a very small copy, a complement of rare signed copies.
Save one for me, all right?
UK store. Or it's in digital format as a Kindle download also from Amazon. So really, buy it. You'll love it. It's a great book to take on holiday if you're fortunate enough to be summering somewhere.
Maybe don't take it if you're going on holiday to the Middle East, is what I would say.
Yeah,
yeah. I've had a number of people, that, you know, friends from the at the bridge, who have sent me pictures of them reclining on sun loungers and reading it. It appears to be that people can only read it when they're nearly nude.
Well done. As a therapist, I'm intrigued by that one, Paul, I have to say. Talking of which, actually, because, I mean, you know, Marco, well, obviously I helped set up the mental health kind of, you know, how does one put it? Signposting service, really, for Chelsea supporters, overtheline.uk. Marco was heavily involved, did a fantastic video for us. So it behoves me to mention that within the context of what we've been talking about today. So if anybody who's listening to this, who's a Chelsea supporter, or anybody really, who's struggling a little bit with their mental health, you will do worse than going to overtheline.uk, because it's got some very useful advice about where one can go if one's struggling. And let's face it, most of us will be struggling at some time in our life or other. So I would commend that to you. Gents, I haven't had this. I mean, I know it sounds weird, but I haven't had this much fun on a Saturday morning for far too long, actually. It's been great. Always lovely to see Marco. Lovely to see Paul again. I hope I catch up with you, you know, again, Paul. Hopefully we can have a beer or two, because I know you like an ale. And I know that, I mean, like me, you know, when I lived in Lots Road, I used to like the, what's that bloody pub called? The Chelsea Ram.
The Ram, yeah.
Yeah, good booze of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, serves good beer. And actually, there used to be the Ferret and Firkin back in my day, and they used to make their own beer.
That was the Balloon when I was a kid.
Balloon
that was
in the Creek, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was going to, for the longest pub name, the Balloon up the Creek in Lots Road, at the Ferret and Firkin. I don't really know. Kim can remember the name because she worked there. But I, you know, I'm... just really delighted that you've invited me on today to discuss the book. I didn't get anything in way of compensation, and I was told by the government that I've got to go and deal with the Iraqi legal system. And I'm thinking, well, how can I go and deal with the Iraqi legal system when they told me I was tried by a military tribunal? So, you know, it's one of those strange anomalies. You think that's not going to work.
No, it's like that film Brazil, isn't it? You know the one?
I don't know the film.
It's an 80s film with Jonathan Pryce, Michael Palin, but it basically, you know, pokes fun at bureaucratic regimes. And apart from everything else, you're a victim of that on both sides of the fence, I think. But there you go. Yeah, there we go. Paul, I hope to catch up with you for a beer. It'd be great to continue the chat. It really, really will. And maybe we talk a little bit more about Chelsea as well. But Paul, thank you so much. You're an absolute star, mate. As I said, it's incredible what you've gone through. Brilliant book. Go out and buy this book, people. You really won't regret it. Marco, as always, delightful to see you, mon ami. And no doubt we will catch up soon.
See you. Are you up next week for the Villa game?
I will be, yes. I'm.
See you then.
Yeah, I'm kind of... I'll tell you what, I will definitely be up and I will be save me a copy of Paul's book and I will pay you some money for it because I love having a signed book. So, yeah, you save me one.
Yeah, we'll do, mate.
Good man, lovely stuff. Well, I'll see you then. Gents, but great to see you both. Well done. Thank you. Really enjoyed that. And up the Chels.
Up the Chels.
Come on, you boys.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates around. You've got your McNuggets share boxes ready to go. Your mates already got booked for double dipping and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.